Okay, I have 9 o'clock, so I'm going to start. The first thing I want to respond to a comment about the class 2 weeks ago, and I think I'm going to share something which at least I hope you'll find interesting. I don't know if you've ever heard it. We were talking about, if you recall, the Ridbaz and his relationship with Rav Kook, and how Ridbaz wrote to him that rather than reaching out to the non-religious, should remember a birkat aminim, and I read it as v'aminim alti tikva, the heretics, there should be no hope. In other words, we shouldn't want them with us, and we shouldn't be reaching out to them. So someone was paying attention, listening, and they wrote in, what was I talking about, birkat aminim? We say v'amalshinim alti tikva, for the slanderers, they're should be no hope. So let me just take a few minutes to tell you about this, and this is something you could tell people in shul, and I think it'll create good discussions maybe at the Shabbos table. There is a prayer in the Shmona Esrei called Birkat Haminim, prayer against the heretics. According to the Talmud, it's described how Rabbi Gamliel asked Shmuel HaKatan to write this prayer. We say this prayer 3 times a day. And I'm sure, at least I hope not the only one here who wondered, I hope all of you have wondered, why in a prayer that's called Birkat HaMinim, there is nothing in it against the Minim, against the heretics. Nothing. Shouldn't take too long to figure out that V'lam Al-Shinim is not the actual original text. That Minim is the original text, and that's the truth. All the early versions, all the manuscripts have, there's different versions of it, but they all have things such as V'lama Shumadim Alti Tikva, V'chol HaMinim Karega Yovedu, that's the Rambam's version. It's all directed against them, Shumadim, the heretics, the apostates, nothing all at all in there against slanderers, and that's why it's called the prayer against the heretics. On the assumption that Min, and it's probably a good assumption, referred to the early Christians, Judeo-Christians, the prayer was changed to the heretics, the slanderers. And it is ironic, and I think a little sad, that today, in the year 2010, when we can have any sitter we want, even in the state of Israel, as far as I know, I don't know what the Yemenite version is, but certainly there's no Ashkenazim, and the Sardim, even Sardic versions are V'lam Minim V'lam Al-Shinim, so they have it half right. But all of our Sidurim have the word V'lam Al-Shinim, and that is a false text. That is a phony text. You'd think that today, when we're trying to get rid of all the censorship and everything, that someone would put the original version of it. But the davening we say every day, 3 times a day, V'lam Al-Shinim is not the davening given to us by Chazal. It's the davening of the censor. Now, let me read you what Art Scroll says on this. This is really something to take home. In commenting on this verse, V'lam Al-Shinim, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm holding it over here under the light. So I have a small sitter with me. It says that, the blessing was composed in response to the threats of such heretical Jewish sects as the Sadducees, Malthusians, Essenes, and the early Christians. They tried to lead Jews astray through example and persuasion, and they used their political power to oppress observant Jews and to slander them to the anti-Semitic Roman government. Well, I guess that Art Scroll has no clue this prayer has nothing to do with slanderers. And first of all, let me say this term observant Jews, to describe the disciples of Rabban Gamliel, is completely out of place here, because the Essenes, let's assume they're the Dead Sea sect, were certainly quite observant. The Sadducees were observant. Everyone was observant. That's not the issue here at all. But take my word for it that no one in history, before the Art Scroll Siddur, has ever claimed that the prayer against the heretics was directed against the Sadducees, against the Malthusians, or against the Essenes. In fact, if you look in the Gemara, it calls it, instead of Birkat HaMinim, the censor text do say Birkat Sedukim, but that's because it's a censor text. In fact, when the prayer was written, these were not even issues, Essenes and Sadducees and Malthusians. And the Essenes, a small group in the middle of nowhere, they're not heretics anyway. No one ever thought they were heretics. And to say that they used their political power as if the Essenes, the early Christians, had any political power, to slander observant Jews to the anti-Semitic Roman government. No one slandered anyone. There wasn't any slander going on there. No one ever heard of the notion of that this is a slanderous blessing until the censors, I don't know, about 600 years ago, decided to change it from meaning to slanderers. So this is a real error, a real doozy here in Art Scroll, trying to explain the blessing of the slanderers. So that's the answer to the question. Couple other things. Some of you might find this interesting. There's a volume of responsa called Lev Avraham by a rabbi who lived in Muncie, a very interesting rabbi named Weinfeld. And in the volume, you can get it on HebrewBooks.org. Also, by the way, anytime you want to take a book on HebrewBooks.org and bind it, you can just click on the button and you can get a soft cover for maybe $10, $15 and you get it at your house within a few days. He quotes the Krach Shel Rome. The question he was asked was as follows: is it permitted to sing Shir Hamalos to the tune to Hatikva? That's the tune my family has been doing for many years. I grew up with that tune in my parents' house, and of course, because Hatikva was started by the heretics, the Zionists, can you do it? And he cites the Krach Shel Rome. And apparently, from the Krach Shel Rome, if you can sing tunes that are sung in church, certainly you can sing tunes that come from the Jewish heretics. But he says, no, it's very different. Because, I just love this response. He says that the Krach Shel Rome is talking about people who are taking the tunes in the church. And we went through this response. And they think it's a good tune. It inspires you to fear of heaven. And they're using it in davening. But it has nothing to do with the idolatry. It's nothing to do with Christianity. It's just that we're taking their tunes and, as it were, we're koshering them. But when you sing the tune for Shir Hamalos to Hatikva, it's because you're identifying with the Zionist movement. You're identifying with the heretics. Hitchavru to Pshara in Porke Ol Toro Mitzvos. And that's much worse. He says the Krach Shel Rome never would have permitted that, because it's not just about taking a tune that you think is going to inspire you. What is it going to inspire you? This tune is going to inspire you to become a Zionist, which is complete heresy. So, fascinating. Let's see, time for two more. Oh, I mentioned this a number of times, so let me tell you what I found in it. This new volume, Mayan Omer, oral answers that Rav Avad Yosef gave to people who stand in line to ask him questions. You have 2 more minutes, so let me just read you some of them. He's in number 17. He's asked, if you have a choice between during Heter Mechira, buying produce that uses the Heter Mechira during the sabbatical year, or buying from Arabs, and not only buying from Arabs, buying from all these different hashkachas that get their produce from the Gaza Strip, buy from the Heter Mechira. I don't think you need to be a genius to come to that conclusion when you know where the money's going to. He's asked, is it permitted in Chutz Aretz with a non-Jew to be a silent partner with someone who has, let's say, a non-kosher restaurant selling the Velos and Trefos, even though he's running it and the partner is only making the money? This obviously would apply to owning stock in all these non-kosher companies. And Avad Yosef says, Yesh Lahakel. And at the bottom, you see the answer, Yesh Lahakel, and then you go on for pages and pages where the rabbi explains. That's interesting. He then speaks about, we're getting close to Pesach, so the very first class of this semester we spoke about Rav Avad Yosef. What does he really hold about Ashkenazic men? Can they become Sfardim and eat kitnios? He doesn't discuss it here, but he does say that normally women should have to adopt their husband's practices, but a Sephardic woman in the land of Israel married to an Ashkenazi does not need to adopt her husband's practices, and she can continue to eat kitnios because the land of Israel is the land of the Shulchan Aruch, and his rules go. Which would again lead you to think that the next step should be that men should also be able to become Sephardim. Finally, I have a few more things, but there's no time. Let me call your attention to something a friend of mine told me. We spoke earlier in the semester about how the tradition was in yeshivas, people often miss davening in the morning. I discussed this when I dealt with the Krach Shel Rome about the Tefillah B'Tzibur. One of my friends has a website, a blog called On the Main Line, and he quoted something that describes the Chida, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, when he came to the city where Rav Nosson Adler, Frankfurt, was famous, the teacher of the Chassam Sofer, the great Nosson Adler, who on his own begins, and then he hires a teacher, adopts the Sephardic pronunciation because he thought it was the most important. Now, Nosson Adler, who wouldn't write down any of his Torah because he held that you only are permitted to write down the oral law when you're afraid you're going to forget it, but he claimed he wouldn't forget any of his teachings, therefore he didn't have to write it down. A great, great Sadiq who actually was put in Cherem by the general Frankfurt community because of his unusual practices. And yet his minion survived up until the Nazi era. The special minion of Nosson Adler, which davened in accordance with the Sephardic approach. Very fascinating. But Chida recalls so when he came to town, and the story is Rav Nosson Adler was quite young, but he would stay up so late davening, he always would miss davening. He'd be up maybe to 3 in the morning, he wouldn't be able to get up. And the Chida made a nice pun. There's a verse in 2 Kings that speaks about, it says, Hinei naya dati ki isha lehim kadoshu over aleinu tamid, which means that there's a holy man of God who passes us continuously. And the Chida read it as, isha lehim kadoshu over aleinu tamid. He always skips aleinu, he always misses aleinu, because he's staying up so late, he misses davening. And I mentioned that this was, in fact, the practice. In many Lithuanian yeshivas, they weren't mocked on davening with a minyan because they thought it was more important to be up very late learning. And if you're involved in a mitzvah, you can push aside another mitzvah. Okay, let us now return to Rav Henkin. We ended last class, I was reading you, and I want to finish some of them, the recollections of his grandson, significant points. And let me pick up with number 17, list of some 40, I think it is. He quotes his grandfather, that's Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, as being a great admirer of Rav Kook, and saying about Rav Kook that he was Gadol Shebigdolim, the greatest of the Gedolim. And even though people disagreed with him, other rabbis disagreed with him regarding Zionism, he was correct. Now, this is interesting because we'll see that Rav Henkin himself was not a Zionist. But later he acknowledges, assuming that's the meaning, of this passage that he was right. Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin says that either that could be it, that should Jews have supported their own state, in which case that means that Rav Henkin later saw that he was wrong and Rav Kook was right, or he says it's possible that this has to do with the separate communities, the dispute over whether the Orthodox should remain in one community with the non-Orthodox, or should they be separate like the Eid HaCharedi. But I don't think that's what Rav Henkin means, because he's not talking about that. He's speaking about Zionism. This has nothing to do with Zionism, the separate communities per se. Then he quotes his grandfather as saying that even though generally he agrees with the Hashkafot of Rav Kook, the ideology of Rav Kook, he says, I asked him, what about the fact that you, Grandpa, you oppose the creation of the State of Israel? And how could you say that you agree with Rav Kook in his ideas? And Rav Henkin replied that Rav Kook did not believe in establishing a state which would be brought about through Muhammad, through war and bloodshed. And that was why Rav Henkin opposed the creation of the State of Israel. We're going to see a lot of this Gullus-type mentality that don't rock the boat in Rav Henkin. But he opposed the state because he thought it would lead to terrible loss of human life, which it did. In 1948, 6,000 Jews were killed out of a population of 600,000. I of course, think this is very short-sighted, because in the end, more Jews would be saved by having the state. But that was Rav Henkin's point. And there's a long tradition of this. A famous story that when World War I broke out, there were certain people who got very excited. They thought this is the beginning of the end. Gog and Magog, it's the Messianic era. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik says, if even one Jew loses his life, I don't want the Mashiach. He says, if the Mashiach's going to come and say it's Mashiach, I'm going to say, go away, I don't want you. I don't want Mashiach to come through the loss of life. What this means in terms of this vision of the eschaton, Gog and Magog, I don't know. But this is another example of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's great stress on human life. So Rav Henkin's point was that Rav Kook supported the creation of a state, but not through bloodshed. I also find that very hard to believe. But that's what he said. Number 19. I asked him, who is greater in Torah, Rav Kook or the Chazon Ish? And he says that his grandfather didn't like these sorts of questions, because who can really decide who's greater? What kind of bad question is that? But he says, when I pushed him on this matter, he answered me that in his opinion, Rav Kook was greater than the Chazon Ish in terms of wide-ranging knowledge. And in other areas, I guess, in terms of analysis, he couldn't decide. I don't know what Bekiyut means here. If you're saying Bekiyut in Shas and Poskim, I don't know. Obviously, if Bekiyut means in all sorts of areas, Rav Kook was broader. Rav Chazon Ish didn't study mysticism and poetry and all these things. But that's what he says. And then he says that the Psakim, the decisions of the Chazon Ish, are more accepted than those of Rav Kook. He goes on to say that Rav Henkin admired Rav Reines very much, the founder of Mizrahi. We had classes on Rav Reines. And about Mizrahi and Aguda, he says that they are the same thing, just that Mizrahi is in favor of the land of Israel and the Aguda is not in favor of the land of Israel. That, I think, is very significant, because normally you've had rabbis who like to put Mizrahi down, many of them in the Aguda side, that they're compromisers, they're not as religious, and Rav Henkin is saying basically they're all the same. Then he says, Mizrahi is kosher and Aguda is kosher, but the Kofrim, that is the heretics, they're not kosher. Very few rabbis speak this way. Most people are in the middle. I mean, most people are on their side. Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg had a very interesting formulation about the difference between Mizrahi and Aguda, which I think is a put down of Mizrahi, but I'm not sure. He said that Aguda is more kosher, but Mizrahi tastes better. So I don't know. I don't know which side ends up on the top there, the one that tastes better or the one that's more kosher. I once asked him which group he associates with, Mizrahi or Aguda, and Rav Henkin replied, I am a Jew. What does it mean to be a Jew? To learn Chumash, to learn Gemara, that's what it means to be a Jew. So an apolitical figure. Regarding the dispute over Rav Goren and the other Gedolim, we spoke about this with Rav Goren, over the Langer matter, Rav Henkin was the only Gadol who came out publicly in favor of Rav Goren. He said that although Rav Goren's position was not accepted by the other rabbis, and therefore it cannot be halacha ledorot, halacha for all time, something that's accepted, since he is the Marad Asra, he was chosen as Rav, his opinion is to be accepted in this circumstance. And truthfully, if Rav Henkin was alive today, he'd see that the Haredi world has accepted Rav Goren. Rav Goren was the one first developed this idea of avoiding conversions after the fact. And now that's become standard policy in the Haredi world. I asked Rav Henkin, what is his opinion about saying Hallel on Yom HaTzmut and Yom Yerushalayim? And he replied that in his opinion, you shouldn't say Hallel. And when I asked him, do you protest against those who do say it? He said no, that they have who to rely upon. And he says that you really can't decide this matter because it all depends on how you view the state of Israel as part of the messianic plan. Bnei Akiva went to Rav Moshe Feinstein in the 1950s and asked him about saying Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. His answer was that for him it's not such a chag, but if they think it's a chag, they have the right to say Hallel. I think he's referring to without a bracha. And finally, he said about the Rugachever, that although he said that all the other rabbis were meaningless and nothing, he didn't think so in his heart. He just that was just a part of his personality. So there's many, many more things quoted in the name of his grandfather, but I think those are interesting. This is what you would call the table talk. You have Martin Luther's table talk. You have Adolf Hitler's table talk. I think the book I showed you before, Mayan Omer, is Rabbi Avadi Yosef's table talk, where in comments you just make when people ask you questions, how you use that when you write biographies, how significant it is. The book on the Rav that we spoke about, Holzer's book, is another example of table talk, offhanded comments. They're interesting. They have some significance. Obviously, if you have an example of table talk versus something where someone published something, the public word is more significant. I was caught with the problem what to do with letters. When Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg or other people have private letters, some people argued that the published word is still more significant than the letters. In fact, that was Professor Tversky's opinion. I disagree. I think that the published word is often written in a sort of a politically correct fashion in order to appeal to certain people, and that the private correspondence, not discussions so much, but actual private correspondence, especially when you have numerous letters, that that is more eye-opening and more significant than public correspondence, than public writings. This became a great dispute in my dissertation defense, where Jay Harris sort of kept out of it, but Professor Tversky insisted that I cannot put so much emphasis on private correspondence. But I'm happy to say that people like Professor Breuer and others pretty much agreed that, I don't know anyone else really who's disagreed other than Professor Tversky, that I shouldn't put such significance in private correspondence. I tend to think that in a private letter to good friends, you say what you really think, whereas something you publish, something you say publicly, is often something that is maybe the edges are smoothed out, but doesn't reflect your true opinion. After all, politicians say one thing publicly and another thing privately. Which are we going to take more seriously? What did he feel about secular studies? Nothing in his writing. Well, he sent his son to YU. Then I think he maybe sent all of his sons. I don't know. But he doesn't write about secular studies. He was not, I think my sense is, from what I've read and from him and from others, is that it was a typical Lithuanian rub. If you look at the great Lithuanian rabbis, almost without exception, one of their children becomes a well-known professor. Sometimes it's the daughters in certain secular studies. They had this sense of love of learning, and in the Lithuanian world, it's almost impossible to find, until recent years, a real opposition to secular studies. The Nitziv speaks about how important secular studies are. Other than some of the briskers, they all seem to value secular studies, not during Torah time. Even the Chazon Ish studied medicine and all sorts of things. Not to take away from time and learning, and not during, not in the confines of the yeshiva. It can't be done during in a yeshiva. But as a pursuit that's carried out separately, there seems to be widespread recognition of the value. This is more of a Hasidic and Hungarian thing, opposition. In fact, before World War II, there was a whole movement in Lithuania, a Torim Derech Eretz sort of movement. You can read about this in Rabbi Karlbach, Shlomo Karlbach, the former Mashgiach of the yeshiva, Chaim Berlin Yeshiva, until they got rid of him. That's the case we spoke about, where he brought Rav Aaron Schechter to a Beis Din, Rav Moshe Feinstein. And to this day, Rav Aaron Schechter refuses to go to Beis Din. But he wrote about his father, who was killed in the war. His father is one of the ones who stayed in the Alten Hanberg, stayed in with his flock. But in this book, he speaks about this movement, which was had schools called Yavna. The center was Kovno, and the leading light was the Kovno Rav, Rav Avram Dov Ber Shapiro. It was about creating a Torim Derech Eretz in Lithuania, not a Germanic Torim Derech Eretz, because obviously Lithuanian Jewry is more Talmud-centered, but this was to be they were trying to create Balabatim who could function in the modern world, which was quickly becoming a world that you needed secular education. It wasn't enough. You couldn't just be a tailor anymore or open a store. And this was going to be the future. Had there never been a Holocaust, you would have had a Torim Derech Eretz, like a YU type of mentality, a Neir Yisrael type of mentality, in all of Lithuania. What's happened in Bnei Brak in the last 30 years is such a distortion of Lithuanian Judaism. And they don't know this. They think that this is Lithuania or something. This is so far from what Lithuania was like for many reasons. But so that's my sense about Repenkin. Now, as I said, there's so much we could talk about, Repenkin. You have two volumes of the collected writings of Rav Yosef Repenkin, not to mention material that's reported in his name and other books. We could be here for weeks. I do want to call attention to what I think are some of the most significant points in his books that caught my eye. See, I'm getting a private... Okay, someone asked me on what basis... Rav Aaron Schechter, the Rosh Yeshiva, refused to attend the Beis Din. This isn't Lashon Hara or anything. It's public knowledge. It's been written about. Lashon Hara, forget Lashon Hara. Rav Shlomo Carlebach published an open letter, which I could send to anyone. It was his letter to the Jewish Observer protesting when they put Rav Schechter on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. And he writes, how could you put this person on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah when he refuses to go to Beis Din? This created a huge scandal. He claimed that Rav Gustman gave him a heter not to go. I don't know if that's true or not. As I said, it created a huge... Because at this time, Rav Moshe Feinstein was the Gadol Hador. Rav Moshe Feinstein summoned him, said he had fired Rav Shlomo Carlebach. Rav Shlomo Carlebach took him to Beis Din. He refuses to appear before Beis Din. I mean, it's almost unheard of to refuse to appear before the Gadol Hador, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and all the Rashi Yeshiva, the elder Rashi Yeshiva of Gifter and the others. I mean, they were astounded. How can this young Rosh Yeshiva, who just took over the yeshiva, refuse to appear before Rav Moshe Feinstein's Beis Din? But what can I say? People forget. It's now 15 years more. It's over 20 years later. And he's been appointed. He's on Moetzes Gedolei Torah. You can find him on YouTube. You can read and attack Nussan Slifkin, Nussan Kamenetsky. This came back a bit because when he attacked Nussan Kamenetsky, Nassim Kamenetsky's position was, I mean, he's a gadol, and he's attacking me, but I don't want to get more into it. It's really washing dirty laundry, but in a sense, it isn't dirty laundry, because Rabbi Carlebach, who's the father of Elishava Carlebach, he made this public, his letter, because he said that this is a terrible chil Hashem, that this is not a reliable rabbi, you cannot have a rabbi who refuses to go to Beis Din, and he has no authority anymore, and I guess where you stand on this... come down to if you're a Chaim Berlin person or not. The Gedolim of Lita were very supportive of Hirsch in Germany. They didn't like Hirsch's approach in terms of secular, of being part of Germanic culture. That's not what they were about. There was no Lithuanian culture, Russian culture for them to be a part of. What they began to appreciate, especially after World War I, and this had to do a lot with the influence of, that's what Carlebach writes about in his book. These rabbis from Germany went to Lithuania, and they got together and convinced them that this was the wave of the future, but it had to be done in a Lithuanian approach. We're going to deal with Ravaran Cutler. Ravaran Cutler had a different position, and he was able to squash movements in the United States. But before Ravaran Cutler did this, the Chaim Berlin Yeshiva under Rav Huttner, Shraga Feigl Mendelowitz, Tarvadas, they were going to open up a college program, exactly what Ner Yisrael did. Rav Aaron had a very different position. He was more on the extreme, but the typical Lithuanian Rav was not like that. And even Rav Aaron, it was only for his sons, as we've spoken about. Rav Aaron's daughter was a graduate student in Columbia in political science. And if you want to know about Rav Aaron's extremism in this, though, there was an article by a rabbi, passed away, I think it was last year, Rabbi Meshulov. Not Rabbi Meshulov, no, but by Yoav Hinkelman, who interviewed Rabbi Meshulov, who wrote about how Rav Yisrael Meltzer, who was much more moderate in these areas, how he disagreed with his son-in-law, Rav Aaron Cutler, and when this rabbi was kicked out of the Sutz Yeshiva by Rav Aaron Cutler, he went to live with Rav Yisrael Meltzer. Now, B'nai Brak, I don't want to get into it now. B'nai Brak is very, very different. Has nothing to do with what traditional Lithuania was all about, for many, many reasons. And B'nai Brak never could have developed Yisrael if people had to work and make livings and be out there in the world. It's a completely artificial society that was created because people were able to live on public funds. So when you have an artificial society like that, you're going to have views that are not part of the normal way that Jews lived. Jews were not being supported by the government in Lithuania. You had to live a certain way, and the economic situation between the wars was terrible. This was the year of the Great Depression. It was obvious to all the figures that Jews needed to have different sort of parnassa. So it wasn't an ideological type of Torim Derech Eretz like Hirsch writes about how secular studies will enable you to appreciate and understand Torah better, and that there's a world of wisdom in the Schiller, that sort of thing. No, it was a practical Torim Derech Eretz that the Jews need to be. And together with that, there always were Lithuanian Jews who became great intellects, and they respected that. You should see the way these Lithuanian rabbis write about professors. It's a big deal, the professor. In Hungary, they would say Professor Yamach Shemo. It's always a negative thing. But in Lithuania, they've always put great, there always was like a sense of respect for these individuals who left, who were from Jews, and nevertheless had a secular education and helped the Jewish community. Look at how the Nitziv and others related to religious maskilim. There was religious maskilim in Vilna, and you had Harkavi and in St. Petersburg, and all, you had a whole, unlike in Hungary, where the maskilim became reformers and heretics, you had a whole class of Shomer Shabbos and religious maskilim, and Rav Yitzchak Spector was very close to them, the Nitziv was very close to them. We're going to do classes on Rav Yitzchak and on the Nitziv, and we'll talk about this whole phenomenon, which these were the people who came to America, many of them. Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak, the early Rosh Yeshiva were all Mizrahi. They were maskilim. People like Rav David Lifshitz and others knew Hebrew poetry. They knew Bialik. They came from a Mizrahi. Mizrahi was very strong among the Lithuanian rabbis, and they were read the biography of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, how he knew Russian literature and Hebrew literature. This is not at all unusual. Rav Henkin has a book. It's included in its collected writings called Eidus Yisrael. It's published in honor of Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg. Yisrael Rosenberg was a Lithuanian Rav. He was the honorary president of Agudas Rabbanim. We've spoken about this many times. An honorary president of Ezra's Torah, and also he was president of Agudas Rabbanim. On page 156 of this book, Rav Henkin discusses a question that many, many people dealt with after the rise of the State of Israel. What Hebrew pronunciation should we teach children in our Jewish day schools now? And the typical Ashkenazic view has always been, keep our tradition, the Ashkenazic tradition, Al Titosh, Torah Simecha. Rav Kook has a tshuva on this. And Rav Kook says you can't change the pronunciation. Rav Henkin disagrees with this. He begins by pointing out all the ways that Ashkenazim don't distinguish letters which should be distinguished. Aleph and Ayin. Tet and Tav, when Tav has a dagesh. Samech and Tav without a dagesh. Vet and Vav, and all the letters we all know. Since we know we have to pronounce these differently, we're told this by the grammarians, therefore, he says, we should teach the children in accordance with the Sephardic pronunciation. Now, the Sephardic pronunciation is not always correct also. As I said, Tav and Tav without a dagesh, and Tav with a dagesh, most Sephardim pronounce it just T, both of them. When really the second one should be more of a th. But does some distinguish it? The point being is that, the important point is that Rav Henkin was not one of these Ashkenazic centered people. He looked at the issue and he decided that, you know, the Sephardim are correct on this matter. He was, in dealing with more significant issues, very much in the mold of those rabbis who didn't want to rock the boat. What to do when there's problems with the Jews? The Jews have to be quiet. They have to use the approach of the Shtadlan, that sort of thing. Rav Henkin would have been outraged, I am certain, seeing what happened last week in trying to get this execution halted, the way the Jews, instead of using the traditional approach of the Shtadlan, of quiet diplomacy, of meeting privately with people, you know, to call Jews out to protest in front of people's houses, and email. I mean, he was very opposed to that, and he writes about this. He goes so far as to say that after the first pogroms in Russia, the only thing that happened was that windows were broken. And yet, what did the Jews do? They formed defense organizations to show that Jewish property is not to be taken lightly. And Rav Henkin said that this then led to deaths in the next pogrom. When the non-Jews started coming down the streets to throw rocks, the Jews went out to meet them with their defense squads, and that led to fights and deaths. In other words, Rav Henkin is saying that Jews should not have tried to defend themselves. Jews should have just been quiet and let it pass. It's very hard for us today to have any sympathy with that sort of position, especially post-Holocaust, when we see what all this led to. But Rav Henkin's point was that the strong Jew, the Jew who goes out to fight the non-Jew, that Jews are not supposed to do that in the Gaulis. There's a limited amount of anti-Semitism and even the persecution that they should accept, because rocking the boat is going to be more dangerous. And the proof, he says, is that when Jews did try to defend themselves, it made matters worse and it led to deaths. He wrote about how we shouldn't put the partisans during World War II on a pedestal. you know, the rebellions, the Warsaw Ghetto rebellions, and all these things, because he writes about how this really just led to destruction. How could there be any more destruction? That's not the point. From his perspective, you don't do things that will lead to... If you're going to be killed, then eventually you'll be killed, but you don't do things that are going to lead to you being killed sooner. He says that all those Jews who were saved during World War II were saved because of quiet diplomacy. You can think of all sorts of things. What's the guy's name? The Brandt's mission, Kastner's mission. You got other examples. The Palestinian Jewish government had the Havara Agreement. That's how you save people. What did the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt do? It didn't do anything. It killed a few Germans, but in the end, it just led to the destruction quicker. So whereas Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg sees the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt as the only thing we can be proud of during the Holocaust, he waxes eloquently about how Jews of all different ideologies, Bundists and Orthodox, they got together to show that Jewish blood is not cheap. Rav Henkin sees this as a bad thing. This is not something we should hold up on a pedestal, and this is not the way Jews should respond. If they're coming right at you to kill you, you can defend yourself, but not to organize some sort of revolt which is doomed. As I said, it's very hard to see this, to be sympathetic to this sort of position, but he argues this continuously. He's particularly strong against those who are criticizing Jewish efforts in Israel, Israeli efforts, for rapprochement with Germany. This was Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin and his followers thought that this was the worst thing imaginable. This is the early 1950s. Even before that, there started to be talk. Jewish blood is still warm, as it were, and the Israeli government wants to establish diplomatic relations with Germany. Obviously, there was important reasons to do that. First of all, Germany was going to be an important country. Also, there was the issue of reparations. Germany... had money, as it were. Should we just let Germany get away with this? All the Jews had property, and these Jews were exterminated. The billions of dollars. They don't have any family left that it should go to. The state of Israel saw itself as the inheritor of this property, and so reparations were thought to be very important. But Begin was very opposed to this. Rabbi Chaya Weinberg also wrote against taking reparations money. Rabbi Henkin is more pragmatic. Look at Israel. He says, Israel is surrounded on all sides by Arabs. Israel's weak. Israel needs to do what it must to protect itself from its enemies. It needs money. It needs friends. Germany was pledging to be Israel's greatest supporter. The fact that, we're not talking 2010, we're talking in the early 1950s, a country of murderers, which is, they're all just running free. A few of the big shots were sent to jail, but... all the average murderers or the people who were involved who allowed the extermination to proceed, they just went back home and continued on with their lives. Pagan says, nevertheless, we're not here to punish Germany. That's not. We're here to make sure that the state of Israel is strong, and therefore we need to reach out. And in terms of reparations, he brings from the book of Daniel how in Daniel asked Nebuchadnezzar to show mercy to the poor. The poorer Jews, which Rav Henkin understands to mean monetary support. And Rav Henkin says, if the Jews of Babylonia requested and received, were willing to receive charity from Nebuchadnezzar, the man who just destroyed the Beis Hamikdash, then why shouldn't Israel be able to take money from Germany? Quite significant, I think, is that he also says that we cannot accuse the German people of perpetrating the Holocaust. That's no big deal in the year 2010 when we look at it historically and say, you know, you can't blame all Germans, there were some good Germans. But in the years after the war, Hebrew literature as a whole just speaks about the Germanim yimach shemo, the Germans as a whole, the German nation, the German land. No distinction is made. And Rav Henkin distinguishes. Incredible. He says, we cannot accuse all Germans of being murderers. We can't speak about the German people, just as a qua people, the German nation, as a nation of murderers. And he also says that this, if we do this, this can boomerang on us, because there are Jewish traitors in the United States. And our defense is that you can't judge Jews, the Jewish people, by some Jewish traitors. He's referring to the Rosenbergs here. We can't judge Jews as Judaism and the Jewish people because of some traitors By the same token, you can't judge all Germans because of what some, even many, maybe you want to say most of them did. Really interesting stuff, I think, here. Look, we're suffering with this today. It's a shame I have to say this, but almost every single week I've been teaching this class for almost 4 years now, there's been a scandal. A scandal, usually an identifiable Jew. I mean, how long is it going to be because until people begin to associate the non-Jews, good-meaning non-Jews? Is it something about Judaism? I certainly don't blame the people in Florida who draw the right conclusion that all these people, really, they don't care about cops. They don't care about the law. As long as it's a Jew, they'll do anything to get him off death row. They don't care. I mean, that what other conclusion can they draw? And Rav Henkin is saying here that it's very important for us to distinguish, not to judge all people by a group, or else we're going to be judged by a group, and we don't want to be judged by a group. The fact that, as I said, every week you have another scandal here, it's very important for us, and we always point out that it's not, that's not all of us, and it's not what our religion teaches. By the same token, we can't look at Germany and blame all of Germany. I don't know of any other Jewish figure, especially religious figure, was speaking, and it's not just, I understand, there's an element here of self-interest. He's saying that if we accuse Germany as a nation, then we leave ourselves open for being accused as a whole, that we're all traitors or we're all communists. But I don't think he would write that unless he was sensitive to the fact that there's more to it. There were tzaddikei umos ha'olam. There were non-Jews who were not interested in what the Nazis were about and opposed them. He says about those in the state of Israel who opposed the state, such as Naturei Karta. And by the way, Naturei Karta in those days was not the Naturei Karta today. Naturei Karta then was more of like a Satmar type thing. Today, Naturei Karta has become so crazy, going to meet with Iran. And, I mean, these people are just off the wall. And but not all Naturei Karta is like this. I see David Eisen's with us. He's in Beit Shemesh. He can tell us. There's Naturei Karta in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and they cause all sorts of terrible things, all sorts of problems. No question about it, and they're very anti-Israel. But they are not the same Naturei Karta that's going out to Iran and meeting with the Holocaust deniers. In fact, I have a book written by one of the leaders. He's a Sephardic guy, actually. Biton is his name. In Beit Shemesh, in which he attacks these Naturei Karta. I mean, the Naturei Karta, the ones from Muncie, these crazy ones, they sent a letter of congratulations to Hamas after some terrorist attack, and they defended it as the proper Jewish approach, because maybe if we kiss up to them and congratulate them on their terrorist attacks, they won't kill us. And in this book, Rabbi Biton speaks about how these people are just crazy, these Naturei Karta. And he even gives example of a Naturei Karta person who was killed in a terrorist attack. So these Beit Shemesh Naturei Karta are really the continuation of the old Satmar Naturei Karta. So Rav Henkin says to them, very, very strongly he says, that even if the government is not following Torah, it's a secular government, you have to treat it with kavod. This was the era when they were making all these protests and all these crazy things. And what's his proof? Elijah the prophet ran to greet Ahab before he wants to kill him, but he ran to greet Ahab, and he brings other examples. Even Nebuchadnezzar is called God's servant by Jeremiah. So governments need to be respected. I told you in previous classes about the Brisker Rav, who also was very opposed to the Naturei Karta and what they were doing. The Brisker Rav said that the state of Israel is no different than the Polish government. And in Poland, you never would protest. You wouldn't go out and have these crazy rallies. If the Polish government said something, you would be quiet and listen. And the state of Israel is no better than the Polish government. It has to be treated like any other government in exile. And if you wouldn't do it in Warsaw, you wouldn't go out and protest the opening of a movie theater in Warsaw. You wouldn't do it in the state of Israel. The fact, the Brisker Rav said, the fact that these people go out and protest, even though they claim to be anti-Zionist, that shows that they're really not anti-Zionist, because they have a shaychus, they have a connection to the state. They grant it chashivus, importance. They think it somehow represents them or has something to do with them, and that's the reason they're going to protest. But if they really understood the state of Israel, they had nothing to do with them, they wouldn't. The only time the Brisker Rav said you could protest would have had to do with drafting girls to the army, because he thought they were going to come take Jewish girls. But if the state of Israel does something to go protest, he says that shows that you think it's significant. Instead, you should just treat it no different than any other country. And if I'm not mistaken, his sons continue that path today. Let me read someone here. Yeah. Although, truthfully, in Europe, Rabbi Kelman, it wasn't this so much. There was plenty of financial issues. That's where the culture comes from. But no one assumed that in Poland or Russia, you should be honest with the government. It wasn't a democratic government. There are other reasons why they left. There's all sorts of reasons. But in America, it's very hard, I would think, to... you can say as much as you want. Like Noah Weinberg used to say, don't judge Judaism by Jews. But after a while, when and so many people are doing it, you have to say it's Judaism. And when I say Judaism? If you take all these people and they're being arrested left and right for financial misdealings, it's obviously that the form of Judaism they're growing up with and they're being taught does not see this as problematic and sees this as okay. We're not dealing with one, two, or three people. We're dealing with a complete culture, and truthfully, there's scarring that justify this. So I wouldn't want to publish this. It would create a scandal, but it is Judaism. After a while, you can't just say it's Jews, because they don't see themselves as violating anything. This new one, this Rabbi Balkani, who was involved in trouble years ago, this is the newest Chilul Hashem, and it gets worse. Benny Rogoznitsky, the Chazan we spoke about last week, if you read his defense, which I'm sure it's going to be shown to be completely false, because he's also being sued by Gateways, that Haredi program, and another program, but he claims that his mother-in-law gave him this money for his organization, Cantor's World. She claims, of course, that she gave it to him to give to Magen David Adom. And because his organization, Cantor's World, is not tax-deductible, therefore he brought it to Dweck, and he brought it to the Kassin's group to launder the... Dweck, who went to Kassin, to launder the money so that they can get a fake tax deduction. In other words, his defense from stealing the $136,000 from his grandmother is that, no, his grandmother gave it to him, but all he was doing was... And his defense, this is his defense, that he didn't steal from his grandmother, but he illegally laundered the money through the Kassin group, so he didn't have to pay, so they got the tax deduction. That's his defense! It's Hashem Yerachem, it's unbelievable. Let's see. Sure, I didn't give money to the OU last year. I refused to give money to the OU because of one of their rabbis came out and attacked Rav Moshe Soloveitchik right before Pesach, and then as saying that he's not a reliable mashgiach. Without having any knowledge or any evidence or anything. And the OU never retracted this, never said anything. So when they called me for my annual gift, I said, I'm just supposed to give you money, and you let this go on. Signing up with Chabad and with what happened last week, for me at least, is enough of a reason to tell them this is going to be a second year. And I'm not interested in giving them. They can make more money, I think, sell more hashgachas on toilet bowl cleaner. They can pick up my little donation. Okay. Rav Henkin, though, was not what you would call a Zionist. As I said, he actually opposed the creation of the State of Israel. But not because he thought that there's a problem with Jews running their own land. The Gullus mentality I've been discussing was the reason. He thought that it would bring terrible bloodshed to the Jews. And he thought this even after World War II, which, there's no evidence that he changes his mind. He doesn't say that he changes his mind after World War II. Before World War II, I can see it. After World War II, we all know that had there been a State of Israel, Jews would have had a place to go. I can't see it. It just doesn't, he says that this is why he was not a member of Agudas Yisrael, because Agudas Yisrael supported the establishment of a state. That's after World War II, actually. So he's publicly telling us that after World War II, he opposed the creation of a state. Now, I think from his perspective, he's looking at, after the Holocaust, where 6 million Jews are being killed, you declare a state, the Arabs invade, that's going to be another half a million. That'll be the complete destruction of the Jews will not have been able to survive that. He's thinking that after 6 million, now we're going to sacrifice another half a million. In other words, he doesn't have strength, confidence, that the State of Israel will be able to survive against the Arab onslaught. But that was not the position of most Jews. Most Jews saw the Holocaust, even the anti-Zionist Jews. The Reform Movement was, there were exceptions, Abba Hillel Silver, Stephen Wise, but the Reform Movement as a whole was anti-Zionist until the Holocaust. Most anti-Zionist Jews, after the Holocaust, realized that Jews need to have a state. Rav Henkin thought it was would lead to more bloodshed. But once the state was established, then we have to support it, obviously, and be its strongest supporters, just like Chabad. Chabad was anti-Zionist before the state was established, but once it's established, once the state's established, then the old debates of whether there should be a state or not, be Zionist or not, are irrelevant. The Belzers were huge anti-Zionists. But once the state's established, what, you're going to still have this argument that there should be, it shouldn't be a state? The state's already here. I mean, the only people who kept this were Satmar. And what's Satmar's whole point? The Satmar will agree that you can't. What are you going to do? You're going to close down the state? And you just let the Arabs come in? The Satmar Rebbe acknowledged you can't do anything. He said, on the one hand, we can't close down the state because then the Arabs will come in and they'll kill everyone. On the other hand, you can't recognize the state because it's recognizing heresy. So the Satmar Rebbe's position was we just have to stay in the middle. There's nothing we can do. But this was a minority opinion. All the anti-Zionists came to recognize the state. In practical terms, there's a state. What are you going to do with it? You have to deal with it. And that was Rav Henkin's position. And Rav Henkin quoted Rav Chaim Ozer, his brother-in-law. Rav Chaim Ozer, who responded to his brother-in-law, Rav Chanan Wasserman. Rav Chanan, during the boycott movement against Germany, which Rav Chaim Ozer disagreed with, but once the boycott became a popular thing in Poland and Lithuania, he didn't protest it. Rav Chanan Wasserman continued to protest the boycott. He said, Jews can't boycott. This is not what Jews do. Jews use the shtadl, the quiet diplomacy. And Rav Chaim Ozer said to Rav Chanan that the Jews are also a nation. Because Rav Chanan said that this boycott violates the notion, though, that Jews cannot rebel against the nations of the world. And Rav Chaim Ozer said, well, Jews are also a nation. Which, from what Rav Henkin is telling us, is that there comes a point where the Jews don't have to take it lying down. The Jews also can stand up and do things. And even if you might not think it's the best thing to have a state because it's going to lead to more death, but in theoretical terms, the idea that the Jews don't have the right to defend themselves, of course they do. From Rav Henkin's perspective, it was only a practical thing. What's going to cause a more harm? What's going to be better? But to say that Jews don't have the right to defend themselves, which was the Satmar position, or Chanan Wasserman's position, he said, no, that's not the position. That's not true. That we are a nation also, and there are times when we don't have to take it lying down. He goes so far. This is volume 2, page 216. Check it if you don't believe me. He goes so far as to say that the religious extremists and the Turi Kart and all the rest are responsible for the anti-religious decrees and the actions of the Israeli leadership. That left alone, had the Orthodox Jews left them alone or tried to make peace with the Ben-Gurion and the rest, things would have been a lot better. It's the fact that all these protests and all these rallies, that led the secularists to say, well, forget these Orthodox Jews and become much more anti-religious. He might have a point there. It might be correct. I just think it's significant that a rabbi is saying that, and a rabbi of Rav Henkin's stature. From our standpoint, this gets back to what Rabbi Kelman said before. I've made the point often. You look in America, you look at the non-Orthodox Jews, they basically have respect for orthodoxy, for religion. They don't themselves practice it, but they have respect for it. We don't have anti-religious people in America. And if they're not Orthodox, they're conservative, reformer, if they're atheist, but they're not anti-religious. In Israel, you have anti-religious. So why do you have anti-religious? Because what's religion in Israel? Religion in Israel is draft dodging, it's getting as much money as you can from the government, it's having no involvement in the civil society, not wanting to have anything to do with general society, what's important, the army, respect for the dead soldiers, all the things that are important to general society. Certain segments of Israeli society, the Haredi segment, oppose it. So we can understand why there is anti-religious sentiment in the state of Israel, because what is religion? They see what religion is. It's not the religion that the Orthodox Jews have in America. It's a religion which is all about the world is created for me and what can I get from it. And Rav Henkin points out that it's this type of attitude which led to anti-religious feeling. Rav Henkin then turns to the American scene. He is very firm in stating that the synagogues in America must welcome anyone. And many people were not so pious, not so religious, but the synagogues must welcome anyone. And then he deals with an issue that was a real issue in his day. What to do about a synagogue that doesn't have a machitza? Huge issue. in the 1940s, 1950s, 60s, you had many Orthodox synagogues that got rid of the mechitzas, or just synagogues that never really had them and called themselves Orthodox. What I mean, called themselves Orthodox, they were members of the OU. 50% of the graduates of Reitz took positions in shuls, this is the 1950s, without mechitzas. 90% of those coming out of Skokie. It came out of Torah Vadas, of Chaim Berlin. Some shuls today, which are right-wing shuls, like the shul in Atlanta, I think it's called Beth Jacob, Manuel Feldman shul, that was a non-mechitza shul. He was sent from Ner Yisrael there. There was a choice that had to be made. Do you send Orthodox rabbis to these shuls and try to keep them in the fold, and over time you can convince them to put a mechitza in, you can make sure that the children have an Orthodox education, or do you abandon them? And there were plenty of rabbis and Orthodox Jews who said, what do we want? We don't want anything to do with these synagogues. If you look in the old journal Hapardes, they attack the OU. They don't think that the OU is an Orthodox organization because all these shuls have no, that are members don't have mechitzas. But the mainstream Orthodox groups thought that it was more important to send the rabbis out than keep these shuls in the fold. And some of these shuls ended up going to the conservative group, but many of them ended up remaining within Orthodoxy and going back to full halachic observance. Today, there is only one shul in America that's a member of the OU that doesn't have a mechitza. And the OU is so embarrassed by it, it won't put it on its website. It's a Beis Medrash HaGadol in Denver. The former assistant rabbi of West Orange became the rabbi out there. And he, from what I heard, he came even with a letter from a Herschel Schechter giving him a heter to take this position. And the CRC, Chicago Rabbinical Committee, or a conference, whatever it's called, which itself was formed originally all from rabbis who were in these type of traditional shuls, they called them traditional, that is, they didn't have mechitzas, is now, I guess, much more to the right. They grandfathered in these old-time rabbis, but I heard that they refused to accept him as a member of their organization, even with Rav Schechter's heter. But this was very common. So what to do? What should a? It's one thing for the rabbi. We understand a rabbi needs to go to these shuls. This was Wayu's position and other position, other yeshiva's positions also, that the rabbi needs to go there because the rabbi is doing kiruv. But what about a regular Jew? A regular Jew, can he daven in that shul? Sort of Henkin deals with this question. Oh, this was the psak of Rav Regensburg, but when you say Rav Regensburg, I mean, this is the famous psak, but Rav Regensburg is much more significant, because it wasn't just a psak of Rav Regensburg, it was a psak of YU. YU sent plenty of rabbis out there. The Rosh Yeshiva YU, they sent them out from the other yeshivas. So what makes Rav Regensburg significant? Rav Regensburg, however, it wasn't just an ad hoc thing. A whole movement developed in Chicago called traditionalism. And they didn't even see it as really second best, as Harash Shah, as temporary. Rav Regensburg might have, but the movement itself saw this as really legitimate. And they never, it wasn't as if they were pushing to get rid of them, to get rid of the separate, the mixed seating. You had the other shuls, the whole idea was that they had to push for mechitzas, although in practice, I don't know how often that happened. But this movement developed called traditional, with graduates coming out of Skokie. This really lasted until Rav Aaron Soloveitchik came in, and Rav Regensburg became the spiritual leader. So he really gave spiritual authority to that, and it's hard for me to get a handle. He has a letter on what his position was. He has a letter in the book, the Mount Clemens case, in which he defends the mechitzas, how important they are. I think he calls it a custom there, maybe. I think that's what he calls it. But he seemed to give his imprimatur to a whole movement that did not see it as Hara Shah, but as sort of like a lifestyle, not as good, obviously, as regular shuls, but as today, this is the best we could do for some of these shuls. David de Sola Poole, in an essay he wrote in the 30s, said that the mechitzas were falling left and right, that it could be that Orthodoxy would have to come to terms with this. And my sense is, although I could be wrong, that Regensburg really felt that, at least for the near future, this is something we're going to have to come to terms with. And it almost became a chachila in the situation we are now, that it's expected you'll take these shuls, whereas the other yeshivas, it was much more of an ad hoc, and it was regarded as not the best thing. That's my sense. So you're agreeing with me that he allowed it as permanent. They say why you put a limit to 5 years. That's in theory, but you can speak to the rabbis from YU. I've spoken to them. No one took this seriously, and it was winked at you, although they said things like that. There never was any expectation. And you had rabbis who were in these synagogues for 20 years. They were members of the RCA, and no one ever said to them, you have to leave these synagogues, or we're going to throw you out of the RCA. A couple of years ago, a rabbi took over the shul in Teaneck, the Teaneck Jewish Center, which is mixed seating, and I think he was kicked out of the RCA because of that. But so this five-year thing was never really taken as seriously. It was never for real. Al-Rasha could last a very long time. I understood he did not see this as the best thing, but the sense was that he thought that this is the best we can do for now, whereas in theory, at least, YU was trying to push harder to try to get the mechitzas in. So let me just finish up, though, about the individual, though. What about the individual? We all know the famous position of Rav Soloveitchik, that even if the only shul you can go to hear shofar in Rosh Hashanah is a mixed seating shul, you shouldn't go to it. I mean, if the only shul you can go to is a mixed seating shul, and if you don't go to it, you'll miss Kiyas HaShofar, you shouldn't go to it. You should stay home. He describes mixed seating as adopted from the church. Very strong words. Soloveitchik's position, though, is more nuanced than this. Next class, I'll give you some examples of how you have to distinguish between the public Rav Soloveitchik and the private Rav Soloveitchik, and I'll give you a very interesting psak of Rav Hirschel Schechter, his leading Talmud, which I think you'll find very surprising. And I think it should be obvious to all that Rav Soloveitchik even gave that famous psak that don't go to the conservative synagogue, the mixed seating synagogue. If the synagogue was separate seating, but no machitza, he's not talking about that. When he said don't go to the mixed seating synagogue, even if you miss Tkiyas HaShofar, he's speaking to Orthodox Jews. This, I think, is a very important point, which is often overlooked. He's not, as the old Agudas Rabbanim would take out these ads in the Jewish press and the New York Times, saying, don't go to these shuls. He's not speaking to non-Orthodox Jews. Rav Soloveitchik never said to a conservative Jew that it would be better if you stayed at home. He's not speaking to them at all. I'm assuming for them, I think that those synagogues are valuable. I know Rav Lichtenstein has written about how we think that those synagogues are valuable for the non-Orthodox Jews. But for Orthodox Jews, he's saying you can't go into them. What was Rav Henkin's position? Rav Henkin was more liberal than the Rav. And this is in his Sefer. He says that obviously we need a machitza dadavan, and that if the only shul in your neighborhood, let's say you move to a place or the synagogue with a machitza gets rid of the machitza, he says if the only shul you have is one that is mixed seating, he says it is better to daven at home. But he says that if you're in a situation where this will mean that you always have to daven at home. We're not talking about you go on a business trip and you're in a city for a month even, and the only synagogue there is a mixed seating shul, so you daven at home. Rav Henkin says if you're in a situation where this means that you literally have no minyan and you have no communal Jewish life, Judaism, as all religions, is a communal religion. You can't be an island. You can't be by yourself. If you feel, he says, that davening at home is going to be worse than davening in a shul without a machitza. In other words, if spiritually you will suffer from not hearing Kriyas HaTorah, from not being in a community, basically being on an island, he says you have to ask yourself this question, where your spiritual life will suffer so much by not having any communal involvement in the synagogue, and you can imagine this. Well, let's say you're supposed to go a whole year with never going to shul, never having any davening, being by yourself. For most people, this would be very destructive to their spiritual life. He says, then you should go to the shul, the mixed seating shul. He says, when you go there, you should involve yourself in the shul, and you should try to bring them back to complete observance. And you should let them know that this is not the proper way. However, if you feel forced to daven in a non-machitza shul, because otherwise, spiritually, you'll be losing everything, you should go there. And while you're there, you should, as he says, try to let them know and teach them about how important it is to have a machitza. So here you have the great posek, Henkin, greatest posek in America in the 1940s and 1950s, telling Jews that they have to decide for themselves if spiritually they'll be in a worse place off by missing communal prayer entirely. usually we think of post-scheme speaking in terms of yes and no, right and wrong, only laws. What does the law say? What does the halacha say? Here, Rav Henkin shows a great deal of insight and leaves it to the individual. Very interesting. Now, I will end here. Next class, I'm going to show you some stuff about the Rav, which I think will surprise you, stuff that people don't know about. Then I'll tell you also about a private sock of Rav Schechter, which I think will be surprising. And that'll lead us into some other interesting things about Rav Soloveitchik. And then on to Rav Henkin, women and Kaddish, other issues of Rav Henkin, Kashrus. And maybe I think we'll conclude with Rav Henkin next class and move in and start with the Eliezer Berkowitz. A good deal more to do. Let me see if there's... He is talking about mixed seeding, Elliot. That's what he's referring to. I will read it to you right now. This is in volume 2, page 11. Sheyeshbo Seder Letaruvos Im Nashim. If you're in a place where the men are sitting together mixed with the women... And he says it's better to pray by yourself. And if there's no other place to daven, and you're always going to have to daven by yourself, you have to examine, you know, which is worse. He says, and he says also that you have to examine the hope that if the kosher people, the Jews, that is those Jews, the Orthodox Jews, if they are going to daven together in the shuls that don't have mechitzas, on the one hand you have this you're missing out by not davening at all, so that's a terrible thing, and then you have to balance that off also the positive things that if you daven together with them you can fix the situation. Okay, so these are the important words. Adhechan magia kilkel. How bad it will be if you continue davening by yourself. That means your own personal spirituality. And then he says, well, I'm also on the other side, hatikfa alatikun meishtabut haksherim, that maybe if you involve yourself with them, you can actually bring them the proper halachic observance. In that sense, he's really saying that you as an individual could be like the rabbi. If we gave a heter for a rabbi to be a rabbi in a shul like this because of Kirov, you too could be there. He doesn't give, and he says, I'll call Panim, whatever you do, tzarech limchos. You have to protest. He says that if you daven there, midochach. That is, if you feel forced to daven there, while you're part of that community, you have to let them know that it's wrong. What that means is you have to involve yourself, get on the board, try to teach them the proper way. I don't know of any other post-scheme who are so open. We know of a post-scheme who sort of winked at it and allowed people to do this. Right. Rav Henkin leaves it in the individual. What's going to be the worst kilkul? And if you do feel you have to daven there midochak, that you have to make sure that you don't accept it. That's the problem with all these people that end up going there because they have no choice, they feel. And then over time, they begin to accept it. You have many rabbis who took positions like this. And then, as a b'di'eved, and then it became a l'chachila. That's what he means when he says you have to limchos. You have to let them know that this is not the proper approach. But the fact that he leaves it as a possibility, and he says you have to consider ad hechan magia hakilkol, and that's a possibility that you being involved with them will lead to is important. Now, that's that I think is quite significant. Okay. Let's see. He had Yisrael. He had no view about the three oaths. This is not a Lithuanian thing. No, as far as I know, none of the rabbis in Lithuania thought that there was any halachic significance to this idea of three oaths. The rabbis of Lithuania all thought that there was no problem having a state of Israel. The question was, is it a smart thing? Maybe it's not a smart thing because it'll lead to bloodshed. Maybe it's not a smart thing because the secularists will be in control. But the idea that there's some halachic obligation to oppose it, there were opposition in Lithuania. Rabbi Hanan and Rabbi Aaron Cutler, but that was because they thought the non-religious were going to institute a government there that was going to destroy Yiddishkeit. So the three oaths is completely irrelevant for all of Lithuanian Jewry. It's a Hungarian thing, and Hirsch, actually. Hirsch held with it. When you say it's not halacha, it's a gemara. What do you mean it's a gemara? You have plenty of sources that see this as just an agada. And then, if you want to take it more seriously, it was famous, Meir Simcha, and he was perhaps the most important of the Lithuanian Torah scholars. After the San Remo conference, and the non-Jews and the governments agreed to explore the possibility of allowing Jews to return, he said there's no more reason to even think about the Shavuos anymore, assuming there was an issue to begin with in the first place. Let's not forget, the Jews were never going to come and overthrow the state of Palestine. No one ever had any plans about that. The oath was that the Jews don't rebel against the nations. But the whole Zionist movement was about the governments, the Ottomans, and then later the British, or the UN, giving the land to the Jews. So how could anyone have any opposition of the 3-0? So the Satmar Rav's chiddush is that he holds it's still a problem even if they give it to you. But that's not the mainstream view. The mainstream view was that this is not an issue. The mainstream view was that this wasn't even halacha to begin with. It was an agadic statement, and agadic statements don't come into halachic discourse. Well, Avi Ravitsky points out that it's wrong to see this as having no halachic significance. There was this notion that people had that only the Satmar Rav thought this is halachic, only the Hungarians. That's not true. Hirsch thought it was halachic, and there were some others, but in Lithuania, not at all. Now, I didn't say that about the Satmar Rav. What the Satmar Rav said was as follows. After the Holocaust, they said to the Satmar Rav, even if you hold that these three oaths are binding on the Jews, one of them is that Jews can't rebel against the nations, remember, one of the oaths was that the nations shall not, they had to take their own oath, whatever that means, that they shall not overly oppress the Jews. So even if you hold that there's an oath, the oath is binding on the Jews, then the non-Jews violated their oath because they overly oppressed the Jews, and therefore obviously the Jews are not bound by their oath. To this, the Satmar Rav replied that the two are not connected. The fact that the non-Jews violated their oath and they oppressed the Jews are still bound by their oath. As far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as 99% of the world's, 95% of the world's from community is concerned, the Satmar Rav's position suffers from a more fundamental point, among other issues, is that the Jews never went up in force. The state of Israel was given to the Jewish people by actions of governments. So, for numerous reasons, this is never really an issue. There were Lithuanian rabbonim who opposed accepting the UN resolution, because they said we can never give up any part of the land. And if we accept the partition plan, we're tacitly acknowledging that we don't have the rights to the Arab land. But the majority of Aguda position was that, again, it has nothing to do with us. If it was up to us to decide, of course we couldn't give up this land. But we don't own the land now. We're not in control. We have a chance of either getting some of the land or none of the land. And therefore, they said it didn't make any sense to oppose it. In Agudas Yisrael, in the Lithuanian branch of Agudas Yisrael, as far as I know, only Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Elchanan Wasserman spoke out against the state of Israel. Rav Elchanan is before the war saying this, but in 1937, I think it was the Agudah Convention of 37, if I'm not mistaken, they both were opposed to a state of Israel. The other figures were not opposed. Rav Zalman and the others, they were not opposed to the state of Israel. Is assuming that you could have some sort of modus vivendi with the secularists. No, I didn't mention anything about Repenkin Yisrael and the oaths. Repenkin's position was he did not think that it was smart to have a state. He thought the British should continue controlling the land of Israel because he was worried about another Holocaust in the land of Israel, that the Arabs would come and destroy the entire community. And once the state was established, okay, you have to support it. He had nothing to do with the oaths. He would have had no problem establishing a state if he wasn't afraid that it was going to be wiped out by the Arabs. It's difficult for us today to imagine this, but there was real fears that among many that and hopes from the Arab side that they'd just be able to march right into Jewish areas and exterminate the entire Yishuv. There were plans that... I mean, the Jews of Ben-Gurion had all sorts of emergency plans what to do. I mean, it was arms came, there was an arms embargo from the United States. Arms came from the Soviet Union through Czechoslovakia. But the state of Israel hung in the balance. There were people who opposed Ben-Gurion declaring independence for that very reason. Okay, any other questions? Yes. The Aguda had different positions. In the 1930s, their official position was not in support of it. After the Holocaust, in fact, there was a conference in London. After the Holocaust, they no longer engage in active opposition. Even before the Holocaust, they were anti-Zionist, no question about it. But they were not actively involved in trying to undermine efforts. At least some of them were, but the movement as a whole was not. The Ger Rebbe, for instance, had no interest in that. And after the Holocaust, they took no efforts, as far as I know, they're officially or unofficially, to try to prevent the establishment of a state. Their efforts were focused on making sure that Orthodox Jews would have their own place and not be persecuted. In the 1930s, the Aguda, they brought in the Ada Haredi types to London to speak and to offer their perspective. And there was a great fear that if there was a state of Israel, that community would be persecuted, actually, would be forced to be part of it. So in the 1930s, you did have opposition to a state. But if I'm not mistaken, I have to check this. I have the book Mikatovitz ad Hei Be'er. Agudas Yisrael never actually presented an official statement to the UN or to any official body opposing the creation of a state of Israel. When we do Revaron Cutler, I will get the facts about that, because those two did oppose it. But I do not believe that Agudas Yisrael ever officially opposed the creation of the state of Israel. If there were safeguards involved, they might have been opposed to it, but I don't think they ever went to the non-Jews, that is the nations, and spoke out against it. They did speak out about the need to secure the place in this new state for Orthodox Jews and for those Orthodox Jews who won't accept secular Jewish life. You had Moshe Blau came into London, Harry Goodman, the Gudan of London, and they spoke about this. But I will check on this when we get to the next class. But certainly after the war, they never did. And when the state was established, Agudas Yisrael even had a minister in the government. First minister of welfare was the Ger Rebbe's son-in-law, Ishmael Levin. Since then, because they're quasi-anti-Zionist, they have refused to have a minister in the Israeli government. All they have are deputy ministers. So, for example, the minister of health, this guy Litzman, that itself is interesting. The guy doesn't even have a high school biology, probably not even elementary education in biology, and he's the minister of health. But Netanyahu was officially the minister of health. The Shas party doesn't have this history of anti-Zionism and all these issues. So as soon as the Shas party got the power, they had no problem becoming minister. That's not their issue. But as soon as the government was formed, Agudas Yisrael was part of it. He even signed the Declaration of Independence, Ishmael Levin. And his response was that if in Poland, in Warsaw, I could be in the Polish parliament, which was full of anti-Semites, why can't I be in the parliament in the state of Israel? Anything else? I'll stay on for 2 more minutes. The rest of the semester, we're going to deal with Rav Eliezer Berkovitz after we finish with Henkin, and I'm already thinking for next semester, we're going to do Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski and maybe Rav Chanan Wasserman. I also want to do Rav Eliel Ben Amozig, because it's nice to do some of the Sephardic teachers, so maybe we'll do him. Now, as far as I know, he didn't comment. Stay on just 1 more minute. If anyone else wants to, and those who sent me questions, I will try to get to them in the next 3 classes. There are nothing about him or by him in English. His grandson maybe one day will translate material about him. But if you read his grandson's writings, he quotes them, obviously. But not only is there no book or article about him, his life, as far as I know, there's no article in English that really in detail discusses his ideology, other than three pieces on the Svarimblog, or maybe two, by Rabbi Adam Mintz. If you're interested in learning more, go to the Svarimblog, plug in Adam Mintz's name on the side to write. He had, I think, three articles on Rapinkin. One dealt with an issue we're not going to touch at all, simply because we don't have time, the Manhattan Eruv, which is Rabbi Mintz's area of expertise, Eruvin in America. He's writing a doctoral dissertation on it. The other dealt with Rav Henkin as, he called him the forgotten posek. He dealt with, what we even spoke about today, the Machitza issue. And I think he had one more piece. Maybe he might have only had two things on him. I can't recall. You'd have to check. But that's it as far as I know. And I also don't know if there have ever been lectures other than these last 2 weeks on Rav Henkin. Rabbi Mintz, who gives a nice class once a week at his shul, you can find it online on his website, Reim Ahuvim. He might have had a class on Rav Henkin. I can't recall. But I think this really speaks to the fact that Rabbi Mintz meant when he said the forgotten American posek. Here we're talking about someone who was the most significant posek in America in the 1940s and the 1950s, and today he's pretty much unknown. I know his grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who I'm sure is going to be listening to these talks, at least I heard, was quite offended by that. But in a sense, it is true that today people don't know Rav Henkin. There's many, many Gedolim who people don't know about, and Rav Henkin is one of them. He did what? Oh, he did. He spoke. You mean Rav Henkin? He spoke. He gave a class on Rav Henkin. Okay, very good. Okay, everyone. Well, good night, and look forward to seeing all of you again next week.